You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 19th to the 25th of October 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Rachel Pells and Ellie Bothwell and news editor Chris Havergal. Our cover story this week looks at liberal arts education in the US. Is this model of higher education irrelevant and financially inefficient, as critics would have us believe? Does it simply need a little bit of a makeover? Ellie's been exploring the data from the Wall Street Journal Times Higher Education US College Rankings to find out if liberal arts education really has lost its way. Academics from the EU who work in the UK could lose their right to remain here if they spend extended periods of time overseas, for example, on research leave. Rachel has this story and will tell us a little bit more shortly. And a former White House staffer has been speaking to Chris about the need for university leaders in the US to, quote, lean in to their responsibilities as advocates for evidence-based policy making, even if they themselves do not have the most faith in the world about those currently at the very top of US politics. More on that shortly. But first, Ellie, liberal arts. In need of a facelift, in need of a makeover, that's the sort of angle on the headline of your cover feature this week. You've been trawling data from our US college rankings, looking specifically at the lay of the land for the country's liberal arts colleges.
Yes, and the data sort of would suggest that you know, liberal arts colleges are, you know, tend to be very rich. They tend to have very high sort of levels of student engagement, you know, as, you know, is often said, but that they're, you know, perform very poorly when it comes to measures of diversity and inclusion. So, you know, very low proportions of students that are the first in their generation to go to college or that receive Pell Grants, sort of very low numbers of faculty and students from sort of minority backgrounds. And, you know, so we looked at kind of various reasons for that. Obviously, the kind of high sticker price of liberal arts colleges is a big factor in that. And the fact that actually people are put off attending these colleges because they're seen as very liberal, as their names would suggest.
So they're catering for the elites. They're stuck in the past. They're too expensive. Anything good to say about them?
Well, I mean, one sort of trend over the last, well, kind of actually a few decades, has been the change in their approach to education. So a lot of liberal arts colleges no longer focus on a kind of core curriculum. And they don't, you know, they offer a kind of range of more professional degrees now, kind of graduate education. It's not just the kind of arts subjects. And there are kind of, you know, various attitudes to that change. So, you know, some people think that that's actually really helping liberal arts colleges, that it means that they're much more relevant to a wide range of students today. They've got a kind of broad line of options, that more students can now attend them. For some, though, you know, they're concerned that actually it means that liberal arts colleges just aren't, they don't offer liberal arts education anymore. It's kind of, you know, they can't prove their return on investment either. So it's a big debate at the moment, and kind of institutions are responding in various ways to that.
Sure, and then this feature is based on data from the US College Rankings, which we publish in partnership with the Wall Street Journal. Those rankings are reproduced in full in the magazine. You can also find them at timeshighereducation.com. Just click on the rankings tab at the top of the page. Part of that methodology, Ellie, is one of the biggest surveys of US students. Did you sort of get a sense for those students who do go to liberal arts, even if they are a little bit sort of similar, maybe not as diverse as other areas, are they happy with the experience that they have there?
Yeah, it was really interesting, actually. So the survey was about 200,000 students in the US. They were surveyed in 2016 and 2017, and actually the kind of figures that we've collected, you know, the kind of raw data, actually matches quite well with what students themselves think. So a few students I've quoted said that they felt like they were being constantly challenged at liberal arts educations. They could access their professors at all times. They were encouraged to think outside the box. But then a lot of them also said that, you know, it was still a very white and upper middle class institution in terms of the students and faculty, that they were concerned that they couldn't express their political opinions or their views on certain sensitive topics for, you know, fears that other students would be offended. So it did kind of match the raw kind of bibliometric data, actually.
Mm. Not many Trump supporters on campus, I dare say. You can read that feature in the magazine this week. It's also available online. In addition to that analysis of liberal arts, we also published this week on our student pages the top 100 liberal arts colleges in the US. You'll find that online by clicking the student tab. And as I say, you can also access the full THE Wall Street Journal US college rankings on the rankings pages of our website. To jump straight to those, go to www.thewur.com. But moving on, our lead news story this week comes from our newest reporter, Rachel Pells, who joined recently from The Independent. Welcome to the team, Rachel. You've been looking into what Brexit might mean for EU citizens who work in UK universities.
Yes, so EU academics could lose their right to remain in the UK after Brexit if they go abroad for research or other reasons. This comes in response to a parliamentary question that was posed by Stephen Gethins. He's the MP for North East Fife. He asked if the Secretary of State for the Home Department would make it her policy that applications for settled status of EU academics working in UK universities will not be affected by the time spent outside of the UK to support their research activity. That question was answered. It was asked on the 12th of September, and it was answered this month by Brandon Lewis. He's Minister for Minister of State for Immigration. Mm-hmm. And he replied that settled status would generally be lost if a person's absent for more than 2 years. He did say that's unless they have strong ties here.
Family ties.
But they will have to prove that. So I think we already knew that internationals can jeopardise their right to remain by leaving country for a certain period of time. It's the first time, essentially, this has been admitted formally in writing by the minister that EU members, so academics and anyone else, will be affected by this.
It comes at a time as well, doesn't it, I suppose, where generally the UK as a destination, its reputation as a place where academics can come is dwindling. I know we've had people writing in our pages, you make reference to Emily Mitchelson, a senior lecturer at University of St Andrews, who tells online about her dealings with the Home Office. It's just not a pretty picture at the moment, is it?
I mean, I think from my perspective, I'd say that you're right to say it's about the perception rather than the actual sort of machinations of the rules. We're talking here about sort of, you know, academics who spend more than 2 years abroad are most likely to be hit by this. Clearly, a lot of research leave might just be sort of 6 months or 12 months, but, you know, you don't know that before you come to the UK, so it's a real challenge in terms of attractiveness. And it's also about the complexity that it adds into the system. I mean, you refer to the Emily Mitchelson case, and the reason she was writing for us was that she'd been stuck in a 14-month battle with the Home Office over whether she'd be allowed to stay or not. So it shows the sort of complexity that EU academics will have to go through in order to be able to stay in the UK. And also, you know, having to demonstrate family ties. I mean, it sounds, you know, straightforward, but actually it's quite a personal and, you know, potentially uncomfortable process for people to have to go through.
Absolutely. Well, you can read the full story on page 6 of the magazine this week. It'll, of course, be on timeshighereducation.com as well in the news section. You'll find the story there as well. Elsewhere in the news section, Chris, you've been speaking to Kristin Dorgello, a former chief of staff for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy under Obama. You met out in Australia, I understand. What were you chewing the fat about?
Yeah, so it was Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook chief operating officer, who told women to lean in the workplace. Now, as you rightly say, Kristin Dorgello, who was chief of staff at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, says that academics and university leaders in particular should lean in when it comes to public policy advocacy in the US. In the age of Trump and hostility towards higher education in sort of popular debate in the US, I think it would be easy for academics to want to switch off from that conversation. And in particular, what Kristin says, her perception is that academics are wary of engaging in that policy debate because they'll be accused of partisanship. You know, she says that actually there's nothing partisan about advocating for evidence-based policy, and that's something that academics and university leaders need to take really seriously as part of their role, you know, more so under Trump perhaps than before. I mean, the question that arises from this is whether, as well, perhaps we've referred to partisanship, the slightly toxic political discourse that you have in the US at the moment, you know, whether that's something that academics actually want to subject themselves to, if they fear that they risk being abused or ostracised online or whatever,
or indeed just not listened to.
Well, indeed, that's the case. But let's be clear. Kristen DiGallo isn't just talking about tweeting or being on CNN or Fox News or whatever. She's saying that this is something that every individual academic can do. Talking to young people in their neighbourhoods. Talking to people in local pubs. So it's a matter of talking to the people potentially who voted for the sorts of leaders who created this slightly sort of science sceptic leadership that you have in the US at the moment. And also, it's not just about individuals. She's clear on that. She gives the example of the University of California system suing the Trump administration over the changes to the rules for the Dreamers, the children of undocumented migrants. It's something that institutions and academics can do together. It's not just about individuals putting themselves out there.
Indeed. Well, elsewhere in the news section, you can also read Chris's interview with Tanya Rhodes Taylor, a vice principal at the University of Sydney, who's speaking about the status of professional and support staff in universities in Australia as opposed to in the UK. She's well placed to speak. She did make the move across the world fairly recently. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything that we've discussed, you can do so in the comments section at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter, and you can find us on LinkedIn too. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.